Hey, Jackie.
Hey, Patrick.
Traditional medicine historically is focused on physical symptoms, often at the expense of overlooking the mental health component. But how have things changed in the healthcare field involving mental health and awareness, and how can we improve upon them?
Well, I have some thoughts, but I know the perfect person to talk to.
Today, we sit down with Dr. Dawn Goldstein.
She is an assistant professor and the program director for the Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner Concentration Program at Michigan State University College of Nursing.
In addition, she is a board-certified psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner with expertise in mental health and substance use disorders across the lifespan, specializing in trauma, depression, and suicidality.
As the lead faculty in the master's and doctoral psychiatric nurse practitioner program, she has developed, delivered, and integrated mental health substance use disorder and addiction education in synchronous, asynchronous, and virtual technology platforms. Her clinical practice as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner has primarily been in the community settings, mainly serving vulnerable populations, the LGBTQ+, immigrants, veterans, and uninsured individuals with psychiatric disorders in person or with the use of telehealth platforms. Dr. Goldstein currently is the PI or multi-PI of two funded grants involving interprofessional education, mental health, and substance use, budgeting a total of $3 million. Dr. Goldstein, can you share with us your nursing background?
Yes, I can share my nursing background. I have been a nurse since the early 80s. I've worked in various specialties, numerous settings, inpatient, outpatient. I've done home care, quality. Later in life, as I have returned back to school for my doctorate, I also joined the Army as a reservist. And that was in 2009. And I had really started exploring more of mental health as I was married to somebody who was experiencing PTSD. At that time, he had been deployed since 2005 to Iraq and Afghanistan, my husband. And through those multiple deployments and through the care he was receiving at the VA, I started realizing how little I knew about post-traumatic stress disorder or complex trauma and depression and other disorders that even though I knew about them, I didn't live with it and try to help that person seek the help they needed. So that was an eye-opener, and that was something that I really then started to have a real desire for. I worked as well as a civilian employee on a government base. I worked at Fort Huachuca as a behavioral health case manager, and that gave me another experience to see how those who deployed frequently were experiencing the combat trauma. And you know, some individuals come back and they end up with post-traumatic stress disorder, and some don't. But having, you know, at that time living with somebody who was experiencing it and feeling like I was living with it firsthand as a person who's living with somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder and then working with active duty, I pursued that with my graduate degree as I was going towards my PhD and looking at specifically PTSD, but military personnel, veterans as my population. And then looking at help-seeking behaviors as well. So that's where I got that start.
So PTSD is something that, from somebody who's not an expert, I've really seen evolve both in the recognition and in some of the treatments and therapies that have come about since I've been a nurse. What are some of the most recent breakthroughs or evidence? What have you seen in recent years in your own practice?
Well, I think probably the first thing to recognize is that we've seen a huge increase in just how people have experienced trauma by going through the pandemic.
Sure.
And so now we're seeing frontline workers, first responders, experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we know that the VA, the DOD have been doing and working with post-traumatic stress disorder for years and really ramping up different modalities for treatment. But I think we've seen in the last several years now is just how prevalent trauma has taken us. You know, where is it gone now since the pandemic, and just the trauma that we've experienced personally, especially if we've lost those that we care about due to COVID, or we've taken care of patients who have not survived, where we saw before a high rate of PTSD in our military population, now we're seeing in the general population.
And I guess I wanted a little bit clarification with the post-traumatic stress disorder. So what probably most people, unless you live with somebody or experience it yourself, what I think of PTSD is what we see in the movies where, you know, fireworks and kind of like almost it seems like they're having an out-of-body experience, they're having flashbacks. Is that still an accurate depiction of what PTSD is?
I think what we look at is how are we diagnosing? And it's really, you have to look at the first, you know, what's that criteria that I'm going to be looking at to see if somebody meets having post-traumatic stress disorder. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I've experienced combat. It's really any trauma, right? It could be what we've experienced, some natural disasters. We saw that with Katrina. We saw that with the Twin Towers. Any natural disaster can cause trauma. Any personal physical attack, observing or watching somebody who's died maybe violently.
And I guess I would like to know, what are the symptoms that need to be exhibited to be considered or diagnosed with PTSD?
So again, you have to look in the DSM-5 diagnosis, and anyone who is providing treatment, we need to do a thorough assessment and an accurate diagnosis. And so keep in mind, a person has to meet the first criteria, and that's exposure to actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence. Whether you directly experienced the traumatic event, witnessed it in person, the events as it occurred to others, or maybe you learned of the traumatic event that has occurred to a close family member, close friend. It might be an actual or threatened death of a family member or friend. The events must have been violent or accidental. Or maybe you're somebody who's experienced repeated or extreme exposure to adverse details of a traumatic event, like first responders. So meeting that first criteria is very important. Then you look at, okay, do you have these other clusters of symptoms? And there's a cluster of intrusive symptoms, you know, things that are very uncomfortable from the trauma, and negative cognitions, negative thoughts, and also this hyperarousal. So definitely increased arousal associated with traumatic events. So you have to have these four areas of clusters of symptoms and so many criteria that would fit for this diagnosis. Typically, you know, the statistics are about 55 or greater of all of us have experienced a traumatic event, at least one, in our lifetime. But only 8% of the general population will experience post-traumatic stress disorder. For military personnel, it's about a 38% chance, likelihood. So general population is very low. Now, we have seen an increase due to the pandemic, that is for sure, because we've had far more first responders, hospital workers dealing with frequent deaths. We're seeing a lot of people who not only experienced that trauma and some post-traumatic stress disorder, but now they're also burned out. And burnout is different than post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, burnout might be, I have to work long hours. I have mandatory overtime to put in. I have to work the COVID floor that I was never, you know, prepared for. I may have to work without PPE. I may have to work with fewer people on the unit. Those more administrative aspects are what cause people over time to just burn out.
Dr. Goldstein, how well are we doing as healthcare providers of getting people suffering from PTSD into providers to be evaluated and treated? Is that something we're doing better at? Is that something that we're still struggling with?
Dr. Crane, we are still struggling with this. We know that even before the pandemic, we had an opioid crisis. We had an increase in anxiety and depression and suicidality. All of those things have increased even more so following the pandemic. That we know that 1 in 4 Americans will experience a mental health problem or misuse alcohol or drugs in their lifetime. And these disorders are among the most highly stigmatized health conditions in the United States. And they will always remain a barrier to getting care. That's one major barrier, is that stigma. But I think it's important to know how prevalent mental health conditions are. You know, they can range from mild to severe. It affects somebody's way of thinking, their mood, their behavior. It has contributing factors such as biological, life experiences, family history of mental problems. But we know that in Michigan, we have 1.3 million Michiganders with a mental health diagnosis, and 38% are not receiving care.
Why do you suppose they're not getting care?
It's multi-pronged. Stigma and discrimination are huge barriers to receiving help. We tend to label people who have a mental health disorder, and we say that person that's schizophrenic or that bipolar or that alcoholic. We never do that with medical conditions. We don't ever say that cancer, that coronary artery disease person over there. So we really need to look at our language and how we communicate. Cost of care remains a significant barrier for many individuals, and that inability to afford the cost of behavioral health care, inadequate or no coverage for mental health treatment, is significant. Most adults with a diagnosable mental health condition are typically going unmet. You know, those needs are going unmet. They're not being treated or they're being undertreated. And you figure most people are going to primary care, and that's where it is initially first diagnosed. The other piece is we don't have enough psychiatric providers. So we know that psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioners, there's not enough. And with this increase and this lack of what I'm going to say is mental health parity and addiction equity in our state, we are seeing that, you know, whether they can't afford it, they don't have access to the treatment. But we have way too many, many people living in the state who just cannot get the services they need because we don't have adequate care. And then on top of it, what we should see is that on an average, every 350 individuals, there should be at least one mental health provider. In many of our counties in Michigan, especially the mid-upper level and the upper peninsula, your statistics are you would be one provider for about 1,600 individuals living there. So we're way below a national average. Michigan actually is about the 42nd lowest state in accessibility to mental health care and having enough mental health care providers.
You provided a pretty good segue. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the role of psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the work that they do, could you give us a little bit of information there?
So they have that advanced degree. They have a minimum of a master's degree. And then they have a specialized core curriculum specific to psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner education, whether it's covering neurobiology, psychopharmacology, psychotherapy, substance use disorders, and then they're board certified. So they're able to see those patients who are at most risk, who are vulnerable, who are living in the rural populations of Michigan, definitely the rural regions, those medically underserved regions. Physician assistants can also play a role, but we know that it really is going to require far more, not only psychiatrists, MDs or DOs, but also advanced practice registered nurses who are psychiatric specialized and trained and board certified. The beauty of the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner program is that not only do you need it provides that advanced degree, it gives you that additional specialized curriculum and clinical hours, clinical placements that are in all settings, its lifespan. It also provides not only the ability to manage medications, psychotropic medications, but also psychotherapy. Definitely having more psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners would be a huge benefit to the state. And that's why we've been very fortunate to receive a grant from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, along with another college in the state of Michigan, that is providing recruitment and retention type of stipends. So grants have been made available to several of the colleges. Michigan State University is one of them, that will pay stipends for students who are interested in this advanced practice nursing profession as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, up to $30,000. So we're seeing that even our State Department of Health and Human Services realize what a crisis we're in as it relates to the opioid overdoses and mental health disorders, especially the increase that we've seen in our youth, that we just don't have enough. And hopefully with grants and programs like the Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner Program at Michigan State University will help meet some of the need.
I think it's fantastic that the state is recognizing, and not just only recognizing and supporting, but supporting financially so that we can have trained, educated professionals to help the citizens of Michigan. And I'm curious, and I don't know if you know this or not, are other states following suit? Is this something that, you know, the state of Michigan is perhaps modeling after other states?
Other states have been doing different things. And plus, you know, it's more complex than that, than just being able to provide more providers. We know that you may have more providers, but we also need to get insurance companies on board with providing that reimbursement at the same rate. So we're seeing a discrepancy in reimbursement rates for services provided, whether you're a physician versus a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner or a family nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. We need to see more fairness as it relates to this reimbursable rate. We also need better mental health parity in the state. So let's say we do have enough providers, but if my insurance doesn't cover it, or if they only allow me to be seen six times out of a year, or I have such high copays, or I live in a region of Michigan that, you know, it's too far away to get to a provider, there's just many things to consider. And so when you think about, yes, we know that other states have done remarkable work as far as making all nurse practitioner education available in the state of Pennsylvania. That has been something that's been enacted in other states as well. And then we also know that there are some states that have a much better mental health parity law because they're, you know, we have a federal law that very few states are following. And states that do have that good mental health and addiction services parity also have a good reporting component, and they are getting more providers who work in those areas. The other factor is full practice authority. Those states that have better mental health parity and addiction services because they're following the federal law have full practice authority. So not having that in this state of Michigan is a barrier to treatment.
So you mentioned that, you know, in certain parts of the state, it's difficult or challenging to get to their provider. But there are modalities or platforms available. Telehealth, I think, for sure, has definitely increased during the pandemic. Have you seen that being utilized?
Definitely. We have seen that across the board nationwide with the pandemic. You know, regulations have loosened and allowed for more individuals to be seen via telehealth if they could not be seen physically. So we know it's been a huge help as it relates to providing medication-assisted treatment, providing mental health services to those who are in remote rural areas. And for Michigan, that would be our Upper Peninsula or just the Upper Lower Peninsula or any rural region, which is a lot of Michigan.
How effective is that instead of being in person? You know, is it over the phone? Do you see the person? Is it just as effective as seeing somebody face to face?
Well, we've seen with research that it can be just as effective, especially for mental health treatment. I would say that most of it is using video. So that video and audio component really is what you're going to see. Now, during the pandemic, when there were regions that maybe had broadband issues or issues with connectivity, there were only ways to get a hold of people via the phone. But we're finding, I mean, that's better than not being able to be seen at all or connecting with somebody. So some care is better than no care, but the ideal and what's been researched to be shown as most effective is that telehealth platform that has the video component to it and the audio.
So Dr. Goldstein, we talked a little bit about the role of the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, and you're currently the program director for the psych mental health nurse practitioner program at the College of Nursing. What do you think are some of the most important things that you hope your students take away from their education?
Well, the first thing is, luckily, they're coming in with that strong desire and passion to work with this population. What I'm hoping is that they take the skills, they take the experiences, they take all of the knowledge that they're going to learn, and they can apply it into the communities that they live in. I have a lot of diversity within the cohorts, and I have a lot of individuals who are in very medically underserved locations, mental health service provider shortage areas, and most of them will go back to trying to fill those needs in the communities they live in. And that's what we need to do, because we're getting students from all over the state, and actually some live in other states as well. But being able to provide them an education that enables them to be competent and safe and effective and have the base knowledge and enough clinical experience that they can now apply this in an inpatient, outpatient setting. That's what I want my students to be, as competent as they can be, as well as passing the National Certification Board exam. But I really want them to take this back to their communities, which I think that they do.
So along with training the next generation, educating the next generation of psychiatric nurse practitioners, so what else can we do to ensure that mental health care is equitable and accessible for all individuals?
Well, we need to be informed. And I would say that's the biggest thing, is we need to understand sort of our mental health system in the state of Michigan and how people are served in this state and how community mental health might be different than what you might receive from a primary care, or who can get seen where. It's very different. The Medicaid expansion has just been fairly recent. We are definitely not ahead of the curve. But I think as just general population, we need to be more informed. And I think that's another beauty of being a faculty member is I can help guide my students and facilitate their learning and give them opportunities to help inform the public. So I've had several of my students do a policy analysis on mental health parity, as well as behavioral health integration in primary care. And they've looked at existing policies that didn't go anywhere, that have failed. And by providing enough history and then doing a really thorough analysis and then getting opportunities to speak at venues, as of yesterday, two of the students presented at a policy forum that was held in Lansing. A lot of the public was able to attend, legislators. So we need to inform not only everybody, but legislators also need to be informed, and they need to hear personal stories as to how things are not equitable. The students are providing webinars for the Mental Health Association of Michigan as well to inform the public. So I think it's our job as faculty to help ensure that our students are knowledgeable and have the tools and can share that in various ways, because we're training them to be leaders in the community. And we need to come up with ways that we can inform the citizens, inform everyone who lives here. And I think there's a lot of complexities to this delivery system here in Michigan. And as I had mentioned before, full practice authority is another one of those barriers. So when you think of overall, you know, there's a lot of barriers receiving mental health care. Beyond the stigma and the discrimination, we have put forth our own barriers as relates to making access to care accessible and affordable.
As you and I hear, we know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. So, last words, what do you think individuals can do to support mental health and promote awareness of mental health issues in their communities?
Well, I think there's a lot of things, what I really appreciate that there's a lot of toolkits that come out from different organizations like the Mental Health Association of America, even Mental Health Association of Michigan, supporting these services. We also know that we have services available for our students at Michigan State University through the Counseling and Psychiatric Services. But I think as far as Mental Health Awareness Month, I think anything that just gets to the forefront of people's mind that mental health is an illness. I mean, it can lead to an illness. We know that we all have mental health, but having an illness or a disorder is not that uncommon. And we need to be more aware. And we need to be aware of those who are around us and look for signs and know how to encourage people to get additional help, seek out services. So there's a lot we can do individually. You know, we can take part in other people's mental health just by being resourceful, and we can support others who need to seek out and get that help. We know that, too, there's been a recent text 988 that directly takes a person, if they text that, to a crisis intervention. So you can call or text 988. Always know that there's help available. There's always hope. We need to help really support other people around us in getting the help. We need to be aware of signs and symptoms of mental health issues so that we can support others and that we can inform, because it is common. It's not an uncommon thing, and it's just as concerning as someone having a medical condition. We need to view it as such and not think of it as something different, something that is part of someone's character flaw, but it is an illness and it needs treatment just like any medical condition does.
Thank you, Dr. Goldstein. Now, Dr. Crane here has the hard-hitting question for you.
Yeah, are you ready for this?
Yes.
The uncertainty in your voice is amazing.
What is your favorite smell?
You know, that's a great question, because it often will depend on my mood. But the smell that I tend to enjoy the most in soap or shampoo, or if I have a diffuser, is lemon.
Huh.
I love lemongrass as a wonderful aromatherapy. So, lemongrass.
Excellent.
What's yours, Dr. Crane?
Oh, man, that also changes. I mean, I really, really like the smell of fresh baked bread. I mean, I think that's kind of a human universal thing. And like right now, just the general smell of spring.
Yeah, yeah.
When everything's coming alive. I mean, those are pretty generic, but I think those are probably it. What about you, Dr. Eisler?
The two that popped in my head was my dog's paws. It smells like Frito-Lays. I don't know what. It's all bacteria, I'm sure. But the smell of my dog's paws is just heaven. And then the other one, the old school Bic pens when you're writing. And the smell of the ink takes me back to the days where we wrote and passed notes in class. That and folded them into intricate little folds to send it to your friend. And now we have texting, so that art is gone. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Don Goldstein, but we also want to thank you, the listener, for joining us. We are your hosts, Dr. Jackie Eisler and
Dr. Patrick Crane.
And remember to wash your hands.
To find your breaking news and latest updates on the College of Nursing, please refer to our website at nursing.msu.edu.
You can also find us on Twitter at MICHST Nursing.
And on Instagram at MICHST Nursing.